Saludos, nuestra gente, and welcome to The Latina Theory, a Spanglish podcast sin vergüenzas. I'm your host, Maria Isa, along with our co-host,
Jessica Lopez Lyman.
And we are two proud Minnesotanas, a Boricua and a Chicana, proud of where we come from and where we are now. We are here to create a dialogue focused on Latinx opinions regarding current events, health, politics, race, edutainment, and a music playlist asazonado with Latinx contemporary, Latinx alternative, soul, hip-hop, reggae, reggaeton, cumbia, R&B, salsa, ritmos afro-latinx, y más. Hola, Jessica. What's good, girl?
That's good. We are here again recording via Zoom.
Yes.
So shout out to all the listeners, and thank you for your patience with our audio, but we're making the best of what we can. How you doing?
Surviving, you know, and just taking it one day at a time and making sure we're staying safe and staying indoors and getting some fresh air when we can. I'm excited for the show today. Obviously, you are in any time about to deliver a baby. You're any minute. So by any means, yeah. it could happen in the middle of this conversation, but we're as we await for baby Carmen. But I want you to, we're going to start off this special episode with introducing a special guest. Jessica, why don't you let our listeners know who we have on the show today?
Yeah, we're so excited. We have Cecilia Munoz with us. She was President Obama's domestic policy director and is currently the VP at New America. This past month, her book, More Than Ready, Be Strong in Being You and Other Lessons for Women of Color on the Rise was published. So we're so excited to have her on the podcast and look forward to getting into some conversation.
Chévere, chévere. Well, let's give a strong Latina theory bienvenidos to Cecilia Munoz, who's here on our Zoom.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
We are excited to have you. This is amazing. Jessica's got a few questions that she's prepared, and I'll also add in my content. But Jessica, why don't we start fresh off? Cecilia, you're in Washington, D.C., am I correct?
Yes, just outside of D.C. in my home in Maryland.
Right on. And how are things over there just before we kick off with the questions on your new work?
So, you know, they're good. I know that I'm one of the lucky ones. I can work from home. I recognize that that's really good fortune on my part. But also, I've had family affected by the virus. I've had family affected by job loss. I think we're all kind of feeling that the world is a very, very different place and kind of figuring out how to maneuver and how to be useful in this new world.
Definitely, definitely. Jessica, I know I see that we are doing the mute and unmute just for technical purposes. Are you back on?
I am here, yes.
All right.
Cecilia, so I have some questions. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, what brought you to the work that you're doing today?
Yeah. So I'm also a Midwestern Latina. I'm the daughter of immigrants from Bolivia. I'm from Detroit. I'm a Michigan girl, although I live in the D.C. area now. And I worked my whole career in policy. So I was at the National Council of La Raza, which is now Unidos U.S., for 20 years. And I went from there to the Obama White House, where I was served for 8 years. For the first 3 years, I did a job called Intergovernmental Affairs, which meant managing the president's relationships with state and local and tribal governments. And then for 5 years, I was his domestic policy director. So I got to work on a whole range of you know, intense but important things. And I now work at an organization in D.C. called New America, and I'm focused on trying to help local communities move forward, especially towards economic equity, and also I'm very, very focused on working on helping governments and NGOs do a better job of delivering the services that they deliver, which feels kind of important in this moment when the government is, you know, Congress has enacted $2 trillion of economic relief, but it's not getting to about half of the people it was intended to get to. And so that's something that we're spending a lot of time on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the administration you were working with to our current one is very much night and day in a lot of respects.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that has to be a very challenging experience, right? To see, put your heart and soul in something and it can very quickly change.
Yeah, it feels, I mean, I will say the person who sits physically in the office that I used to sit in is Stephen Miller, which I just have a hard time. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a guy who feels very differently about our community than I do, needless to say. And I worked on other, I worked on pandemics when I was in the White House, including, I don't know if you remember the H1N1 bird flu that we dealt with in 2009. But I am familiar with the kinds of decisions that the federal government is supposed to make if you are putting the safety and well-being of people first. And it's incredibly agonizing to watch this administration make a very different set of decisions, you know, spend 2 months pretending that it's not happening in a way that has endangered us all. So that's, yeah, it's I have feelings about that.
Yeah, we definitely will too. And we'll talk later in the podcast about the latest tweet to liberate Minnesota since we're recording out of here and how it's impacting us locally. But one of the other questions we wanted to talk to you about, especially in all this, you know, your accolades are so impressive, from a MacArthur Genius Award, working in the White House, your latest book. But one of the things that I saw that you discussed a lot was this idea of imposter syndrome. So no matter how legitimate, no matter how many accomplishments, never feeling like you fully belong in a certain space. I know as a faculty member at R1, I definitely face imposter syndrome a lot. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about an experience you had where you felt imposter syndrome, and also thinking about how do you challenge that? How do you challenge yourself? How do you challenge others around you that you do belong in those spaces?
Yeah, well, thanks. It's a great question. So I wrote a book called More Than Ready, Be Strong and Be You, and Other Lessons for Women of Color on the Rise. And imposter syndrome is one of the things that I talk about. There's the reason that I wrote the book is because I think we all, as women of color, go through a lot of the same stuff, but we don't always talk about it. And, you know, I was working in a very rarefied setting. I was working in, you know, one of the highest offices in the White House, in a position of deep responsibility that I was also deeply prepared for. But at the same time, you know, I also in that role, I mean, I had a very public experience of somebody that I worked with publicly doubting that I belonged in that job, which I recount in that book. And that cost me a couple years of confidence. And I interviewed 7 other women of color who are amazing, amazing, accomplished people as I was preparing the book. And every single one of them had a similar story where they were told they weren't management material, or they were told they weren't, that, you know, people thought they were an affirmative action hire and were therefore not qualified to do their job. And I think we walk around with awareness of when people doubt that we belong at the tables that we sit at. And sometimes that causes us to doubt ourselves. And so part of the reason I wrote the book was to share those stories, but also to share strategies that all of the women that I spoke to use. We all do the same thing. When we doubt ourselves, when we can tell that people wonder whether we belong, we kind of buckle down and do the work and make sure that we're over-prepared so that we have the confidence of knowing that, like, we really know our stuff when we go into that room. I talk about doing things like getting feedback kind of relentlessly. So I did a lot of kind of building circles of people that I could trust so that I could sit down with them and say, you know what, like, I'm not sure I'm getting my point across, or that meeting that I just had didn't go well. Help me think through what I did wrong, what I can do better, or help me understand whether this is really me or whether there's something else going on. So getting feedback matters, being prepared matters, but I also think it matters to walk in with the knowledge that just by virtue of being Latinas, by virtue of our experience in the world, our presence in the room is really important, especially if we're the only one. And I'm frequently, and a lot of us are frequently the only one or the first one. I was the first Hispanic person to be a domestic policy director. And when you're in that position, you have to walk in knowing that whether or not the people sitting at the table with you understand that they need what you bring, they do need what you bring. And it's important to walk in with that very clearly in your head and in your heart.
Yeah, we definitely talk a lot about that on the podcast, being the only one, you know, in different spaces that we've had encounter. And I know a lot of our listeners can definitely identify with that as well. So we're so excited that your book is out. Maria, you want to continue?
Yes, I'm on the technical side here and getting all of these different sounds. I also have a one-year-old baby in the background who's waking up from her nap. So sorry if I missed out on the last 30 seconds of the conversation, but I have some fun questions to ask on since you're our guest. You know, we definitely get involved with wanting to hear about the work from each of our guests, but we also want to hear from like your personality and give our listeners a connection to, here's this, you know, chingona woman, like we like to say in Latina theory. Here is a guerrera in your own right. And as you spoke, trying to feel comfortable within a space that you were born to do, you know, that you have worked so hard to do. I'm an artist. I'm a musician. My focus in being an activist through my art form is getting inspiration. I want to ask you, where does your inspiration to write and to do the work that you do come from?
So that's a wonderful question. And let me just say, I appreciate so much that you all are putting this together and you're doing it from home and you got children that you got an eye on, and so many of us are juggling multiple things and making it all work. And it's just, it's impressive and it makes me proud. And I'm also grateful for what you're doing.
Gracias.
I didn't start out to write a book because I did, walking out of the White House, I did what a lot of the women did. I kept my head down and focused on trying to do good work for the world. And people pushed me to ask myself, you know, don't you think that you have something to say? And who might that be? Who do you have to say it to? And I realized that I do a lot of public speaking. I speak especially to people who are in the early stages of their careers. And I tell the same stories from my own career because I find that they resonate. And invariably, somebody comes up to me afterwards. And 100% of the time, that person is a woman. And almost all of the time, that woman is a woman of color. And she says something like, that story you told about the time that you were afraid, you know, I thought it was only me. And so I took inspiration from those women who came up to me afterwards and said, you know what? I needed to hear what you had to say because I am right there where you are. You named a thing that I go through all the time. And it made me realize we just don't talk about this stuff, but we all go through it. Mm. And I think sometimes we think it's a sign of weakness, that we have these doubts, that we have fear, that we wonder whether we belong in the chairs that we sit in. And it's time to talk about it because we do belong in those chairs. And if there's like any message that the world is screaming right now, it's that the world kind of needs us, right? We've been leaders all along, but our leadership isn't always understood for what it is. But the fact is the world needs us right now. We need to understand ourselves as the leaders that we are. So I take inspiration from those women who told me, you know what, we need to watch out for each other. We need to share our stories because we'll draw strength from that.
To follow up on that, who are some of your mentors? For us in Latina Theory, our mentorship is huge. We know that we wouldn't be in the positions we are without our abuelas, our mothers, our tias, everyday folks in the community. So who's been in your mentors throughout your journey?
Well, so for sure, the women in my family, the women in my life, my mom, my godmother, my tias, my sister. I didn't have a lot of professional mentors who were women, especially not women of color. But I do recount in the book that there were some men who I got a lot of guidance from and to whom I'm very grateful. People like Raul Isaguirre, who led the National Council of La Raza for 30 years. I worked for him for 16 of those years. And he is a good man and a generous one. And he really encouraged the people who worked under him, men and women, to be leaders in their own right. And I learned more from that than I can possibly express. But I think it's important that, so I'm in my 50s. There weren't a lot of women of color in senior level positions to mentor people my age. And again, the women I spoke to, if they had mentors at all, their mentors were typically not women of color either. So we're getting to a place now where they're, you know, we're everywhere. There should be more of us in corporate boardrooms and in government and in other places of authority. But we are getting there. And I think part of our job is to make sure that we're blazing the trail for people who come behind us and that we're helping them. And also, frankly, taking guidance from the people who report to us in the same way that we got guidance from people who were watching out for us.
Wow, I'm so happy to hear you say that Raul Izaguirre was a mentor. I remember being a young girl, and my mother was a senior program officer for the Otto Bremer Foundation, a Boricua, and similar aspects of what you're saying, you know, the mentorship was different. You were the first, you know, to graduate, the first to go to college, those first, and finding these circles and leadership positions. And also the challenges of being a woman amongst your own comunidad. And Raul yep. always had a voice for the women, being a young girl at NCLR conferences and just doing my best to visit with my mom, who was being a mom, juggling everything at the same time. It was wonderful to see his role in of support and doing what he can to open the doors to put Latinas in leadership roles like Ramona Rosales. And when they opened up the first charter school here in Minnesota for Latinos at Academia Cesar Chavez. I mean, those legacies are now what we have to continue as the millennial generation is now taking forth into these leadership positions. And the history behind it to say, like, there's still so much to do, but we can't forget how it started. And it's our positions, like these platforms here on Latina Theory, for our graduates who are sad that they can't have graduation, but to also recognize that, you know, the movement's still happening and they've got to keep it going for the legacies of our ancestors and those mentors. But wow, I'm so happy to hear the connection, because it's just, it's a beautiful thing. And that's what Latina Theory is here for. We want to be able to attach the different strains of hair to braid and unify our movements and our stories. I've got one more question on my end for you, Cecilia. Do you have any music that you've been listening to in the quarantine as a musician that, you know, gets you motivated or just keeps you at a self-care mental, you know, balance?
So I appreciate that you're a musician. In my small way, I'm a musician too, but I sing in a sort of in a classical choir, and just the ability to make music right now, we can't rehearse and I'm missing it. So I'm trying, actually, it's one of the things I'm trying to be deliberate about, is to have music playing in my home. And, you know, in the times when I'm not working, you know, when I don't need to concentrate on writing something or reading something, it's important that it fills you up. And I'm a big fan of Felix Contreras's on NPR, Alt Latino.
Yes.
As a podcast. And that's introducing me to new music. And I try to, he did a show that was just focused on like music for quarantine, music that keeps you calm, that fills you up. And that's kind of my speed right now.
I love Felix. I was able to meet him in DC this past October for the Descubrile, the Smithsonian. Invited me to perform, and he gave a panel beforehand on how the importance of Latinx activism and music is significant during the time of the trompeta era, as we were calling it. We really don't like to say his name on this show, so we just say trompeta and have a little Trump air horn in the background. But moving forward, I personally want to say gracias. Can you let our listeners know where they can pick up your work, where they can follow you? Make sure we get that so we can share it on our social feed. But Jessica, do you have any other questions too that you want to squeeze in? I know that we're on a time crunch, but
yeah, I have one more because I think it's important that we bring it back, even though we're in COVID. So much of what we've been talking about on the podcast before is what's happening on the border, and you're definitely an expert. And I, you know, in all of the work that we do, we always have contradictions. So here you were a first, and yet in our comunidad, we know that President Obama, as much as he did fantastic things, also deported a very high number of people, which must have been very challenging to be part of those spaces. Could you talk to us briefly before we have to let you go, just thinking about what your vision for immigration would be, what your vision for the U.S. Mexico Central American migrants would be. I think so often we're talking about policy. We know what's wrong, right? We know what the challenges are, but what are the dreams? What are the ways that we can imagine a better future? And since this is your area of expertise, we would love to know, like, what would you want for immigration?
That's such a wonderful question. You're absolutely right that it is really, really easy to know what we're against. And there's so much to be against right now, especially the current administration. I can't say his name either. Has done just epic levels of harm that are almost, it's almost impossible to find the words for how appalling it is. And the advocacy world is doing extraordinary heroic work pushing back on all of that. And that work is tremendously important, but I think we're also not doing enough work to answer the very question that you just asked, which is, okay, so if we know what we don't want, how do we articulate the vision of what it is that we do want? What is our vision of what life should be like for people at the border? And what is our vision for the people who are coming seeking protection? And what is our vision for a system that would really work? And I think the challenge here, and I think it is a totally achievable challenge, is I think the country wants to know, and I think we're, as a country, we are prepared to be generous to immigrants. I've seen it before. I believe that's who we are. Even in this horrible era, I believe that's who we are. But I think in order to get there, we need to present a vision that answers the question for regular folks about what are the rules going to be, and how do we just make sure that there will be rules of the road and that they'll be followed, and that if a system is fair and feels orderly, I think the American people are prepared to be generous, and I think that we're prepared to protect people who are fleeing for their lives and even fleeing economic dislocation. But we owe them a vision of a border and a process that works. And I think in this environment, that means we need to recognize that all of the infrastructure around the border, the policy infrastructure, the law, even the physical infrastructure, is all designed for border dynamics that we had 25 years ago when the issue we were grappling with was single adults coming from Mexico. That's not the border we have anymore. The border we have now is families and coming from Central America and children coming alone. And so what if we envisioned a different system of greeting people when they arrive that recognizes the trauma that they've been through and which does with some humanity the sorting process, which is the government's job to do, to determine who's an economic refugee, who is a potential asylee because of violence, but dealing with those questions with some humanity and recognizing that our border isn't going to be open, and so we have to use some discernment to follow whatever the law says, and I think we need a reformed law about who comes and who can't come. But that can all be administered with humanity and compassion, and we can be working in a way across the hemisphere that provides protection to people who need protection. You shouldn't have the answer to dislocation in Central America. Shouldn't have to be that you cross all of Mexico by yourself. We can be doing much more to make sure that people are protected where they are and in the region, and that other nations are also stepping up. So I think we have work to do to get our arms around that kind of vision and to put it out there for the country. But I really do have confidence and hope that that we can be the nation that we were meant to be. But that requires having a policy vision. It requires answering exactly the question that you asked.
Thank you. You have heard it here from Cecilia Munoz. Her book is out now, More Than Ready, Be Strong and Be You, and Other Lessons for Women of Color on the Rise. Muchas gracias for being here on Latina Theory. We appreciate your work. We appreciate you reaching out to us, and we look forward to reading your book as well.
Thank you so much. Muchísimas gracias. Thank you.
Thank you. Gracias.
Cuídense.
Igual. Stay safe.
Estás escuchando Latina Theory, un podcast sin vergüenzas. Todas
but I'm not your puppet.
And I'll kiss your lips, but I'm not your puppet.
And that was Las Cafeteras, I'm Not Your Puppet. Jessica, we're back on the Latina Theory. Mujer, you're not in labor yet, right?
No, I am not, but I'm breathing heavy like I am, I feel like. So thank you all for bearing with me. But it's good to be here. I'm glad we're still able to record. You know, my due date is tomorrow, so I'll be 40 weeks tomorrow, and this baby is crazy. Big and kicking.
I'm excited, and also like I've been like super nervous. I'm like, oh my god, are we doing too much here? Is baby
coming? I gotta keep busy. I'm not teaching anymore. I'm not working on my book. I'm not, you know, I'm trying to rest. I do my stretch, but you can only stretch and like meditate so long. Then you gotta do something else. So I'm glad we have this to keep going. You know,
that's real. Keeping it 100. Man, it's been a week.
Yeah, and you had a productive week. Can you tell everybody about this insulin bill passing? Congratulations.
Yes.
How did you do that?
Man.
We were all on shutdown.
Shout out to the Insulin for All, Minnesota Insulin for All Advocacy, the leadership from Nicole Smith-Holt, the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act was signed into law on Wednesday. We did it, y'all. We did it, Minnesota. How do we do this? Man, organizing grassroots, just not giving up, having faith, hope, doing what it is. You know, I joined the steps at the Capitol this past year because, you know, last year I was pregnant and I was doing what I could do through my artwork and just social media. But this past year I was like, okay, I'm ready to get myself back in the Capitol. I'm ready to get myself back at these hearings. And I'm ready to share my story publicly in front of legislation. You know, there's one thing about communicating amongst your peers and your friends and your fans through music, as well as youth mentorship. But it's another thing to like, you know, do I want to put all my business out there? But it's like, yeah, I do. My life depends on it. You know, the lives of these families depend on it. And but the influence and inspiration from all of the members that are part of the Insulin for All that gathered, and also the meaning behind the leaderships of the Smith Holt family. You know, Alex Smith, who the bill is named after, died from rationing his insulin. He was 26 years old. He would still be here if he could afford the insulin that we need to live. And his parents, you know, seek justice. These big pharmaceutical companies are murderers. And that's just the facts of it, you know. Their greed, and it puts a price tag on our lives. And they didn't stop. They came up with meeting with their legislation, their local legislators, and taking a stand to saying, hey, we're going to do this big David and Goliath fight. And we need everybody, whether you're diabetic or know someone that's diabetic or not. You know, if you're a Minnesotan, you should be fighting for Minnesotan lives, you know. And because of this now, insulin people who, you know, we're still fighting for Insulin for All. You know, the bill is a step forward, but it still has, you know, that insulin for some in there. Obviously, the GOP Senate came into fighting the grounds with removing a lot of the stuff that we had in the bill, such as it being accessible for everyone who's in Minnesota, meaning undocumented hermanos and hermanas as well, if they're type one. But unfortunately, the GOP-led Senate was fighting. And, you know, we had to make some compromises so that we can get our foot in the door with a law, but that now next legislation session, we can fight to expand it, you know. But because of this, you know, Minnesotans who have a valid ID and proof of residency here that are type 1 diabetic and can't afford their insulin, all they need now is their doctor's prescription. They can go to a pharmacy and get an emergency supply for a month for $35. And if they're uninsured or don't, you know, or meet the levels of poverty and wages that are acceptable, along with just proof of not being able to afford it, you can access your insulin for your month supply for $35. Now people are like, well, what about for the rest of your life? So after the $35 program, then it goes into $50. I mean, it should be free, you know, and that's what we're working on, right? But I'll take the $35 emergency than the $1,300 that I've had to do when I've been in an emergency. You know, I'll take the $50 and I will also be there to fundraise for those who can't afford the $35 and the $50. You know, that's what we're doing. We came up with this. The leaderships of Insulin for All started meeting. I mean, they started meeting at a TGIF, like moms and dads that worry about their children after they're off of their insurance or who don't have insurance, you know, and people like myself that have been fighting the healthcare system to get accessibility to have healthcare and assistance to keep us alive. So like that small circle grew into this movement of awareness. And even throughout the pandemic, we were worried, we were concerned because it's like, we can't go to the Capitol. Are they going to push us aside now and just focusing on, you know, where funding's going to go towards just for the pandemic and just life in general, you know? So we were really concerned. But, you know, Nicole and her leadership, she's the mother of Alex Smith. You know, it's a mother's love for her son's life and seeking justice. It's our voices as diabetics who seek hope and wanting to live for our familias and parents of children who live. That's who won the fight against these large pharmaceutical companies that are threatening and these legislators that, you know, voted no because they you know, they're scared of losing their seat to defend those murderers, those big pharmaceutical companies that are giving them donations. You know, let's be real. Let's be honest. That's what it's about. Facts, right? Yeah. Because the facts are is that people die when they can't afford the medication that they need. If my insulin is just as much as your air, is our air, you know, for me to live. So we won. I mean,
it's so fantastic. It's so nice to have good news because I feel like so many things that have been coming out lately around COVID-19 are just heart-wrenching, you know, and when I saw that y'all had got the bill passed this week, I was so excited. I think now, you know, especially when we have 22 million people unemployed, people are really recognizing that it's not just poor people or working class people, even the middle class being impacted by losing their job and no longer having access to health care.
Yep.
And how that can impact an individual or their family. And so bills like this are so necessary, like you're absolutely right, you know, for your survival. Yep. And for the community's survival. So I'm so glad and felicidades, mujer. That's great that we can like cross that off the list and we'll start the next fight, you know?
Straight up.
Now, I mean, I think hopefully people are becoming more attuned to the healthcare inequities that we've had, you know, in this country, looking at how we're being tested or not tested, right? Looking at the systemic inequities that are really impacting the Black community, disproportionately dying from COVID-19.
It's Black and Brown, you know, it's communities of color, like indigenous communities. I mean, the same communities that are affected by every illness, you know, and the poverty, the communities of that are living in poverty, you know, we lost two West Siders from COVID. One was an elderly woman, and another one was 60 years old who didn't have any major complications in health, was healthy and active in her community and making sure that, you know, everybody was doing okay. And it's unfortunate that, you know, we have folks like what happened yesterday in front of the governor's mansion that are protesting to open up for businesses. Like, think about our Black and Brown businesses that want to open up too, but are staying cautious, like El Burrito Mercado. You know, they're like, you know, we get it and we're doing what we can. At the same time, like our customers, if they're not healthy, how are we being loyal?
Well, and a lot of those people that are out there, and I think about Virginia or Michigan as well. I mean, I was reading something and the narrative was saying, you know, like these people are out there, but they just really want to work for capitalism. And I'm like, no, actually, I bet the majority of those people that are out there benefit so greatly from the service sector, from Black, Brown, and Native labor, that they won't be directly impacted. So they can call on the government to say, we need to liberate, as Trumpeta said, whatever, in his tweet yesterday about Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I told someone, I was like, damn, this is the one time I agree with the president. We do need to liberate Minnesota from fucking colonialism. Not what he meant, obviously. But back to my point, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of these people are out there, able-bodied, privileged in so many ways. They want the service sector to open back up so that they can benefit, because they know that they probably won't be the ones on the front lines dying from that work.
Yep.
And also, you know, it's like, of course, the police don't show up when they're holding their guns and gathering without permits.
Yeah, and that's...
You know, stories where Black doctors are trying to help homeless people and they're getting arrested. And I'm just like, it's just mind blowing to me.
Yeah. And that's why it's important for us to recognize our rights as citizens and our rights as people to speak up for those who aren't citizens or who don't have the levels of understanding or even just self-esteem to be able to speak up or are scared to, because they have a right to be scared. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're talking also, absolutely, like, you know, we have people reaching out to Latina Theory to talk about the census because our gente are scared. I mean, they have rights to be, you know, like it's a society and a government that we can't trust because we've felt that, you know, there's reasons not to, but it's also about figuring out levels of balance. And I think that's what we're trying to do here too on our show, right?
Most definitely.
And taking it
step. Thinking about, like, how do we know what's wrong? How are we envisioning something else? We know this is generational trauma. We know that this is products of colonialism. What are we going to do differently? And I've just been so inspired by seeing folks, some of the mujeres, they're starting like their own jewelry line.
Yeah.
All of the body healers out there doing their online yoga classes, teaching people how to cook, you know, all of those things really definitely feed my spirit when we're
dance parties, DJ dance party. Shout out to all the DJs that are doing dance parties. My dog just shouted them out too in the background. But I mean, it's like we feel frozen because we're stuck inside and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. It's the unknown. But at the same time, like, there's still opportunities and motives that we need to take advantage of while we are in our homes to be able to make change. And that's why, you know, it was so great to feel the success. I mean, it sucked. We couldn't gather together. We couldn't be at the, you know, at the Capitol. We couldn't be there physically, but that wasn't the point. The point is, like, we got the job done, and we can do that if we take care of ourselves now. There'll be a time and day for that, you know. And so it felt good to feel, like you said, good news amongst all of this locura, and recognizing that also there's no stop. We're not, like, insulin fraud isn't done. Our movement isn't over. It's just to show you that one battle was won, and we have to continue to knock down and serve as a leader for the rest of the nation. You know, we are the first state to have a bill of this kind. And it just shows you also the empowerment and the opportunities that we do have here as a state, but also the leadership that it takes to maintain and to continue. And I think that's what's so cool about the group that I'm in with the Insulin for All. You know, they reached out to me saying, you know, we need more folks of color. We're sick and tired of seeing white people just being, you know, in the forefront of talking about these issues when these issues are hitting, you know, your communities. We recognize our privilege as white people. You know, we want to help you in whatever way. And, like, that meant a lot. You know, that meant a lot for me to hear these white women whose daughters have the same disease as me say, you know, we want to support you. We need help, but we know that we're privileged and we want to be here for your family. And, like, that showed me a lot of progress on how, you know, our movements do make change, and we can have that unidos within us, you know, and that there's good people out there.
Absolutely. Most definitely. Yeah, well, keep us posted on what's next, and
yes,
you know, if the bills continue, and hopefully the rest of the nation looks at Minnesota and says that, you know, they can do the same.
Yeah, and for those who want to get involved and also may, you know, have a family member or maybe type 1 diabetic, like, check us out. Just hashtag Insulin for All, or you could at Minnesota Insulin for All on Facebook, Twitter, all your social media. With that, Mujer, I'd like to jump into a song that I want to dedicate to all of the advocates for the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act, as well as dedicate this song to the lives that have been lost because they've had to ration their insulin, and just by fighting this horrible disease that we battle each day. This is by the late, great fellow type 1 diabetic MC. This is a Five Dogs tribute with this Tribe Called Quest song, Oh My God, where he mentions being a funky diabetic here on the Latina Series.
Estás escuchando Latina Theory, un podcast sin vergüenzas.
Listen up, everybody, the bottom line. I'm a black intellect, but I'm refined. We precision like the bullet, target bound. Just living like a hookup, the harlot sounds. Now, when I say the harlot, you know I need the hot. Heat of the equator, the dwarf that's in the pot. Jalik, Jalik, you wind up your hip. Drafting of the poets, I'm the number 7 pick. Licks, 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 boy, on your backside. Licks, 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 boy, on your backside. Listen to the fate of Shaheed, let's it glide. Tip the earthly body, heaven's on my side. Even in Santa Domingo, and I got a gringo. We got mics, when do we go? Know a little nigga who can rhyme when you ask me. Short, dark, and plus his voice is vast. Like
1 for the trouble, 2 for the bass. You know the style tip, it's time to flip this. I like my beats hard like 2-day old shit. Steady eating booty MCs like cheesecakes. My man, I'll be sure he's in effect mode. Used to have a crush on Dawn for Men Vote. It's not like Honey Dip would want to get with me, but just in case I own my condom, then TLC. Now the formula is this, me tipping Ali. For those who can't count, it goes 1, 2, 3. The
answer,
a big up is who I be. Brothers find it's hard to do, but never me. Some brothers try to diss, but Malik, you see him bitching me, not care about them DBMC. My shit is hitting, Trini Gladiator, anti-hesitator, Shaheed push the Vader, from here to Grenada. Mr. Energetic, who me sound pathetic, when's the last time you heard a funky diabetic?
Complimentary and we, the 3 for poetry. I got a humdinger coming hook, line, and sinker. The Timbo hoofs with the prints on the ground. Timbo's on the toes, I like the way it's going down. Down like a lady of the evening. When it goes in tits, just believe it's in. Cause Queens is the county, Jamaica is the place. Take off your boots, cause you can't win the race. Race.
And that was Oh My God by Tribe Called Quest. Shout out, rest in peace to Fife Dog and all those who have lost their battle with diabetes. We're back on here on an uplifting note. Always, we want to go into some Latino entertainment news. Jessica, bring us in.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you haven't been following at all this short film, La Serenata, The Serenade, it just won one of the 2019 winners for the Latinx HBO Short Film Competition. I love this film so much, and I'm so happy that from a few days ago, for the next 2 years, you can watch it on any HBO digital platform. But the film was written by a good dear friend of mine, Ernesto Martinez. He's an award-winning queer Chicano Boricua writer and educator, professor, and he explores racially and sexually marginalized communities. It was directed by one of my dear friends, one of my sheroes, mentors, somebody I fangirl over, Adelina Anthony. She directed it. She's a two-spirit Chicana lesbiana who co-founded Arerista Productions in 2012. And since has produced several short films. So please, please go check this film out. Watch it on HBO. if you don't have HBO, ask one of the homies for a password so you can watch HBO. I promise you will not be disappointed. It's a short film, and I really think, you know, short films don't always get the attention that they deserve. It takes a lot of money and time and other types of resources to produce a film, especially with this quality. So please check it out. Tell your friends, post it, share it. The other recommendation I have is that Vida, which is on Stars, is going to release season 3 soon, April 26th. Happens to also be my little sister's birthday. Happy birthday, Shorty.
Taurus in the house.
If you haven't checked out Vida yet, you are missing out. It is such a good show. I'm so glad they're making another season.
Me too.
So sad that this is the last season.
Me too.
At least they didn't, like, leave us, you know, like, yeah. Oh, you know, they're going to be able to wrap it up. Adelina happens to also sometimes do cameos in Vida, so there she is twice doing all these great things. But definitely check out Vida. We really have to support Latinx cultural productions, especially in film and media, because we make up such large percentages of the population, but we are typically always never seen on screen. So please support. And most of us are at home. If you're not home, you're an essential worker. When you come home, check out these two pieces of fantastic artistic production.
Yo, I want to add another piece too, because I just finished watching it last night. I got a chance to watch it. Is the LA Originals on Netflix?
Yes, I watched that when it came out. I made my students watch it for extra credit.
So dope. I haven't had a chance to come around it and just been hearing everybody else's stories, and it just was great. Me and Muja, my husband, watched it, and it's based on a photographer, Esteban Oriol, an artist, Mr. Cartoon, who turned their Chicano roots into gritty art and impacting street culture, hip hop, and beyond. Just really the great images and footage of, like, the past, you know, history of just hip hop. And, you know, my husband was talking about, he's like, wow, it's great to see this, because, you know, amongst the Latino and Black community, you know, there's so many different separations amongst that they want to consist of in our histories. And it's like, stop. You know, we are in this together, just like the Puerto Rican and Black community in the Bronx had its influence in hip hop. The Chicanos had the same influence in hip hop on the West Coast. And from style to fashion, style, sound, and lifestyle. So shout out to Esteban and Cartoon, y'all. It was very well made, and also showing the truths of, like, the successes, but also the reality of being an artist, you know?
Yeah, and I love that at the end, you know, not to give too much away, but of course, one of the worst enemies in a lot of these artistic films, gentrification, and how it comes in, you know? And I loved watching LA Originals. Definitely recommend that too. I'm glad you brought it up. And I just want to plant the seed for any little chingona out there that wants to make a version of that for the mujeres.
Yeah.
Because that's my one critique about the film. It's a very important story. But I'm like, if we become any more side chicks on the arms of these men, you know, we were doing other things as well, too. And so
definitely.
I think it's a great example of an untold story that I'm glad it's there and exists, and we definitely have to make more documentaries like that as well.
Straight up. Special shout out to the homegirl, to Rachel Ramos, doing big things out in Hollywood. Boricua, videographer and director. She's doing some amazing, amazing work with Avra and Oprah. Like, big shout out, Minneapolis connection and Boricua connection right there. So, like we said, we want to hear more from our listeners. Give us your critiques, give us some news, share with us your favorite songs to add in our playlist. And if you're also an entrepreneur, we want to support your businesses, support your art, lo que sea. Thank you to our guest today, Cecilia Munoz. Make sure you pick up her book. We'll have the link on our social media. And stay safe, all right? We love you. Mucho amor. We're going to close our episode here with a little music by Chicano Batman with their Pink Elephant. Pa'lante.
Estás escuchando Latina Theory, un podcast sin vergüenzas.
She's the thing. with you. Just like in the movies, she kills for fun, decapitating heads like the Shogun. Yeah. The skyscrapers are tall. What you gonna do when they fall? Now I'm heading for the hills. All this trouble ain't worth the thrill. All this trouble ain't worth the thrill. Yeah. Style.